Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
How are you doing? Good to see you. Could you join me and stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance, please, to start our meeting tonight?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Thanks for coming out tonight. I'm very happy to be here. I want to welcome all the Washington State Cougars, who are, I'm sure, happy tonight that the Huskies are going to the big game. One of those Cougars is our legislative director, Brian Baumender. Where's Brian? Is Brian out here somewhere?
He's in the lobby.
Well, we'll ride Brian hard on this one. The Huskies have not been to the Final Four since 1973, and the reason is that was the year that they cut me, actually. And it's been sort of, you heard the Sports Illustrated jinx, well, that jinx is now to be broken this year. I don't know what you think. I think this is the most exciting basketball team I've ever seen, and I just think they're a wonderful group of people. And the reason I love them so much is they just play like such a team. You know, like you listen to Nate Robinson talk about, he says, look, the one thing I want people to remember me by is he was the guy who wanted his team to win over everything, you know. And it's just such a refreshing attitude. These guys don't have dollar signs in their eyes. They're just playing for each other. And I just love Coach Romar and Ken Bones, a good family friend of ours, too. So I hope they're going to go all the way. Well, that's the good news. And now it's time for a little reality check. And I want to thank you for coming tonight to talk about Social Security, which is a challenge and certainly a big issue for the whole country. You may wonder why I'm here tonight, because there's a lot of argufying going on in Congress right now as we speak about the family with the terrible challenge in Florida. And the reason I'm here is basically because I invited you here. And I didn't think it was appropriate to not show up. When you were here, and Mr. Buffett has come all this way to join us to talk about this important topic. Now, this is not on topic, but I think it's fitting and proper for me to talk just a bit about this issue that's in the House of Representatives tonight. Obviously, all of us have strong feelings for the family that is faced with this challenge in Florida. And most of us, at one time in our lives, have had a family member in some sense that had these kind of issues in some small way, so we know how tough it is on families and how different people have different views. My view on it is that we actually did have a vote on this Thursday in the House. This is an issue that the Florida courts have dealt with repeatedly over the last, I think it's 15 years, I think. It's gone up to the Florida State Supreme Court, I think, twice. The Florida legislature has attempted to actually countermand the Florida State Supreme Court. The Florida State Supreme Court came back and said the action of the legislature was unconstitutional. And again, the Florida courts have responded to rule on the constitutional issues in great, great detail. Given that, I did not think it was appropriate for the U.S. Congress to intervene in that state court decision. And whatever you think of that, I can certainly respect people's divergent views on end-of-life decisions, but I think it's a very dicey prospect that when we have these extremely controversial issues, to think Congress should intercede in one particular case or another and start sort of countermanding decisions by state courts. I think that can lead to judicial chaos, if nothing else. And I think, frankly, I think it's very sad, I have to say this, I think there was as much politics in what has happened here as there was compassion. I think that's very distressing. Reading the memorandum that floated around the Senate about the political repercussions, about this is good politics to push this issue, that's very disturbing to me when you understand how troubling and how difficult it is for a family in distress like this to play politics. It's very disturbing to me. Nevertheless, this will pass. It passed Thursday. We had a vote on this in the budget. The Republicans put this provision in the budget, and we had a vote to try to take it out. So my vote was not going to be
the tie-breaking vote, that was pretty clear. So I decided it was my duty to join you here tonight, and I hope you agree with that decision. I hope that I don't think I was the wrong player. And I hope that things go as well as possibly for this family. Now let's turn to Social Security if we can. I thought I would spend about 10 minutes talking a little bit about some views I have and some questions I have, then I'll turn over to Mr. Ken Buffman, who's come all the way from New Jersey, is that right, Ken? From New Jersey, to share his knowledge bank with us. And I'm a little bit humbled tonight because we're talking about the pro from Dover here, talking about Social Security, and any number I have is within about 100% of the accurate one. He's got everyone down to the dollar on these figures, so I'll really look forward to talking with him. But I thought I'd take a stab to share some thoughts with you before I turn it over to Ken. First thought, I think it's really important in any discussion of Social Security to comment on how successful this program is. It really is the most successful federal domestic program in American history. It has driven the rate of senior citizen poverty down to very close to a nullity. It has changed dramatically the way people lived. You know, I was talking to some fellow who was up close pushing 100 a while back, and his comment was that Social Security is not about dollars or cents, it's about dignity. Because what really changed is that seniors in the pre-1930, early 30s, and late 30s era did not have their dignity. They didn't have dignity to make decisions about where they would live. They had to live in somebody's basement or whatever chicken coop out back they could stay warm in. And they didn't have the dignity that one would hope to have in the golden years. Social Security does not entitle people to live in Rancho Mirage next to Bob Hope's compound. But it does allow people a certain amount of self-respect that goes with having a foundation to at least be able to survive with your dignity intact. And it has been a spectacular success to allow families to make decisions about where they want to live rather than let poverty force them to live where they don't. So it just has been an extremely successful program in that context. Secondly, it has been extremely successful because Americans feel good about it. They feel it's fair. They feel it's just. They feel it's honorable. They don't feel it's some sort of welfare program that a bunch of louts are hanging around in Cadillacs on. They feel that they're hardworking people that paid into this trust fund for many, many years. People know that it's actually the generation behind us who's now funding it rather than a savings plan. People, I think, are beginning to understand that. But it's accepted by people. So it's successful in that respect. And third, it has the great virtue of being accurately named Social Security. And the word security is not a misnomer. It is there now. It was there then and is going to be there as long as I live and as long as my kids live, I believe. It's secure. It is a guarantee. It does not depend on the whims of Wall Street or the whims of Chinese decisions to lend to the federal government to fund our deficit or the whims of any particular auditing scandal that Enron or WorldCom or Tyco was involved with. It is secure. It is a check that you know is going to be there for you. So the security aspect of it has been very, very successful. Now that word to me is really the word that is at stake. It is at great risk as a result of the President of the United States' decision to put security at risk in Social Security. Because his efforts to partially privatize Social Security take the security out of Social Security, number one. And I don't think that should stand. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that security remains. And I'm going to fight as far as I can to stop this partial privatization of this very, very important issue. This is something that I think Americans are starting to see the light of. I just saw a poll results the other day that the more that people learned about the president's plan, the less they liked it. I've sort of tongue-in-cheek. I tongue-in-cheek suggested maybe I could ask the president to join us here in the first district. That might help illuminate these issues. But again, it fundamentally, bottom line, it really is about security. But before I talk about some of the details of that, turn over to Ken, I just want to put Social Security in the context of where the country is in other fiscal issues that we have. I believe Social Security at some point is going to have a challenge that will involve some tweaking. But I believe it is third on a list of imminent crises that we now have, the first being the federal deficit. If you think Social Security, whatever you call Social Security, the current deficit is 10 times worse because it is current, and it is here, and it is not hypothetical or speculative. It is right here today. It's a $430 billion deficit today, not counting the Social Security surplus. It's $600 billion if you do. It's growing larger. It's based on fraudulent accounting that would make Enron blush, because it doesn't take into consideration the fact we're going to have to fix the AMT tax. We have a budget that doesn't take into consideration the Iraq War. That's great budgeting. We're in the middle of a war that's going to, has lasted 2 years with no end in sight. Costs $85 to $100 billion a year, and this president didn't put it in his budget. Now, I have a little trouble with a budget that leaves out an $85 billion topic and sort of sweeps it under a big, big rug. That's a big lump and a very big rug to have an $85 billion thing not in your budget. It just passed on a supplemental budget. That's all deficit spending. The budget does not take into consideration the rate of medical inflation that we have. So the fact is, the matter is that if you consider Medicare a challenge in 2048 or 2052, you should consider the deficit an imminent generational crisis, and a moral crisis, I believe, in 2005. And that is not being dealt with. The budget the majority party just passed guarantees budget deficits as far as the eye can see without making any serious effort to eliminate it, and is going to get worse. I think that is the height of irresponsibility to say you want to deal something in 2052 when you have the same fiscal crisis today and you won't do anything about it by dealing with the reductions in tax revenues that the president wants to continue to give to his wealthy contributors. So that's number one. Number two, the president, and I will give him this, I think it's healthy to be talking about long-term fiscal challenges like Social Security. But somebody ought to mention the word Medicare to the president. Social Security, if assumptions are correct, will pass kind of the tipping point where more money starts to go out of the trust fund than is coming in, I think, 2018 or 2019. And the president indicates that he's concerned about that. Medicare passed that tipping point last year. Mm-hmm. It already tipped. If you look at the amount that there is a, quote, shortage in Social Security, it's about $3 trillion over 75 years. For Medicare, it's $28 trillion. So it's six times larger, if you will. So just put that into perspective. And third, when we come to talk about a solution to the multiple fiscal challenges that we have in the federal government, just think about this one factoid. The tax revenues, the president essentially hemorrhaged out of the federal budget in his tax cut that he wants to make permanent, are six times larger than the entire potential shortage in the Social Security Trust Fund. So the president willfully, consciously, with malice aforethought, took out six times more out of the revenues of the federal government in his tax cut, 60% of which went to people who earn over $100,000 a year, myself included. Over 60% of that went to people who earn over $100,000 a year, and one-third of it went to people who earn over $250,000 a year, heavily, heavily weighted to the wealthy among us. And he took that out of the federal revenue stream. That's six times larger than this entire problem. Now, at the moment that he tells us we have this fiscal crisis that's going to doom Social Security, he wants to make permanent this hemorrhaging. He slipped the wrists of the federal government, or bleeding all over the floor, and he wants to allow that hemorrhaging to continue. And that is a debate that we're going to have and we'll be vocal on in the next several months. Well, that's kind of just a background on some of the fiscal issues that I think are appropriate to take into consideration when we deal with this issue. I have a lot more to say because you know I'm in Congress, but at this moment, I'd like to turn the floor over to Ken, who really has been a very, Peter's very worried. I'd like to really thank you for your, thank you very much for setting this up. Really appreciate this and getting such talent in here. And Clarence Morocki, who has helped us here tonight. And where's Kenny? Kenny Edelman, Adam Bartz, and Andrew Fuller. Where's Andrew? My staff, I hope you guys will get to know if you have any questions afterwards tonight, to grab them too, because I'm going to be an empty sheet after this. I won't have any more factoids left. So. I want to introduce Kenneth Buffin, who's here from New Jersey. Kenneth is a member of the Social Security Committee of the American Academy of Actuaries. He's a fellow of the Society of Actuaries. He's held numerous, I'm talking numerous, national positions on various actuarial boards, including director of the actuarial practice of the Conference of Consulting Actuaries. He has an MBA and PhD, originally from the University of Waterloo. Waterloo is kind of interesting because some have suggested that might be the president's. I really can't think of a person who is could be more adept at shedding light on this issue, so I'm actually thrilled that he could join us. Ken's going to talk a little bit about the current status of Social Security, and then we're going to open up for questions. Ken.
Thank you, Jay, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just delighted to see the attendance here this evening, and it's a real pleasure and privilege for me to be invited to address this audience. As Jay had indicated, I'm active in the Social Security area, particularly with the American Academy of Actuaries. The Academy is a Washington-based institution. It is independent, it is professional, it is nonpartisan. And our role at the Academy is to provide technical advice, and we're the public policy voice of the profession, so that we would communicate with Congress. We regularly appear before Congress, various committees, and we produce a number of issue papers. These are basically briefing papers on various topics. I've been the co-author of a number of these issue papers on Social Security issues. And I know that this is a tremendously important national issue at the present time, so I wanted to share with you some of my insights and my opinions and those of the Academy regarding the financial status of Social Security. And I'd like to address just two issues, and that is, what sort of financial shape is the Social Security system in? Is it solvent? Solvency is the term that we use, the technical term to say that there will be money there when you need it. And then sustainability. Will the system be there 25 years from now for the next generation? Will it be there with adequately strong financing 50 years from now for the subsequent generation? And indeed 75 years for the generation after that. 75 years is an important measure because that is in the law as the period over which the actuaries at the Social Security Administration are required to make projections of the cash flow coming into the system and the benefit outgo going out of the system. Now let me explain Social Security financing in its simplest terms. The Social Security system was set up in the 1930s on the basis of a simple social principle, and that is that there would be an intergenerational transfer of revenues from today's workers to today's retirees, so that the payment of taxes, the payroll taxes, for Social Security would be dedicated to the provision of retirement income for the part of the population that is retired and entitled to Social Security benefits. That system has held up remarkably well over approximately 70 years now. And as a democracy, I think we have to pledge our belief in that system and our desire politically to maintain that system. It's under attack currently. The proposals that you are hearing for reform, so-called, in terms of the introduction of individual accounts, are really a critical blow at the whole basic social structure of Social Security. So I want to address what I know are two of the concerns. That is, how do the actuaries go about making these projections? What is involved? What sort of results are shown? And how reliable are those estimates? And what does it mean to us when we stand back and take a look at how solid is our Social Security system from the financial standpoint? Now, there are two sources of information that you should be aware of. One is that there is an official board of trustees for Social Security. These are political appointees. And they prepare an annual report. And it's about to be released next week. I think the 2005 annual report on Social Security will be released next week. That contains a large amount of data and information prepared by the chief actuary of the Social Security Administration based in Baltimore. The secondary source of information about the financial condition of Social Security comes from the Congressional Budget Office. And there are some minor differences between the conclusions and the reports and the methodology as between the Social Security Administration and the Congressional Budget Office, but they broadly come to the same conclusion, that we are perfectly solvent, perfectly sound for a reasonable future. Jay mentioned the crossover point. And in terms of the actuarial solvency of the system, I can confirm that the trustees state, on the basis of their best estimates, the Social Security system is at least 100% solvent until and through the year 2042. That is confirmed independently by the Congressional Budget Office studies, which actually extend that out to 2050. Now, what goes into those particular projections? Here, basically, the actuary is required to make a projection of how much is the revenue stream coming into the system, and how much is the revenue stream going out of the system. Now imagine that you are the actuary with that responsibility. What would you do? How would you go about meeting that challenge of trying to estimate those revenue streams? Well, there are two basic sets of data that you need, or two groups of data. You need the demographic data to just count the numbers. How many people will be in the workforce? How many people will be retired and receiving benefits? You need to look at trends in labor force participation. You would need to look at the trends in birth rates, the formation of the next generation coming into the system. And obviously you would need to look at the retirement rates, and you would need to look at the survivorship rates of those in receiving benefits. I would stress that Social Security is not only a pension system. It provides very significant benefits to survivors and to the disabled. So the children, for example, are a significant number of beneficiaries, among the number of beneficiaries for Social Security benefits. We're not just talking about provision in old age, in retirement age. So we need to have all of those demographic factors clearly identified and projected out. And the projection period, as required under law, is 75 years. And you may ask, well, how can anybody know what's going to happen 75 years in the future? And it is true that as you go further out on the projection scale, the estimates become less and less predictable, less and less reliable. A good actuary, let's say, can make pretty reliable estimates after 25 years, but you're going to have less faith in those estimates the longer out you go on the time scale, 50 years or 75 years. Now, the other side of the equation is the benefit outgo. How do you estimate the benefit outgo? Well, here you've got a complex formula for determining benefits that is based on the earnings record that is then adjusted into real terms, inflation adjusted, to provide the level of benefits that you expect the population to be entitled to, and then you have to estimate survivorship. So that there are fairly complex calculations involved in both revenue streams, and the actuary's role is to ensure that there's a reasonable balance between those two revenue streams. I'm very confident, and I'm prepared to stand here today and say that on the basis of my judgment and my knowledge, that the system is solvent and it is sustainable. You shouldn't be worried that the system cannot be managed out beyond 2050. There are indeed some concerns out beyond 2050 where the actuarial projections show that we potentially, once we've got the crossover point, will have a greater outflow on benefits than we will have on income. And at that point, we will have used up all the trust fund assets and we will not have an interest income on the main trust fund assets. But we can tweak the system. There are a number of minor adjustments that we can make to the system to make it sustainable going forward. Many suggestions have been put on the table, and we at the Academy have in fact modeled 10 major areas of potential changes, minor tweakings to the system. And I just want to share with you what some of those ideas are and suggest that you take time to access our website. It's at actuary.org, www.actuary.org, and you can use our own computer model to play the Social Security game. You can go into our computer system and tweak the system in many particular ways. Let me just suggest a few ways, and you can do this right on our computer system. Retirement age. In the law at present time, retirement age will move to 67. It had been 65. It's gradually moving forward. As people begin to, as we experience the phenomenon of greater life expectancy, as mortality rates decline, people living longer, there's a question as to whether it is still appropriate to use the 67 retirement age. We might even want to extend that out beyond that. That's one way that we can incur some savings on economists. The tax base itself, 6.2% of payroll, employer and employee, goes into fund the system. One possibility is, if there is a shortfall out there, is to either adjust that rate above the 6.2% or to raise the ceiling on which it applies. At present, there's a maximum ceiling that 6.2 rate applies to of $90,000. A significant part of that shortfall would vanish simply if we raise that ceiling, and we would apply that 6.2% on all earnings. Those earnings themselves would create additional benefits, but would add significantly to the actual balance in the system over 75 years. And in a way, there's some social justice in that. Just as Jay mentioned, that the Bush administration's tax cuts have benefited the most highly compensated members of our society, it would seem that it would not be unreasonable to have the Social Security shortfall that's projected beyond 2050 funded by clawing back some of those tax concessions that have been made by putting the entire income level go to the website and play the Social Security game and see how much the deficit will vanish. My wonderful guests here in Bainbridge, Barry and I, Van Peters, we sat down in his home yesterday and accessed the computer website of the American Academy of Actuaries. And within 2 minutes and two clicks of the mouse, Barry had completely solved. It's not insurmountable. It's very easy to do, but it takes will, it takes commitment, it takes political motivation. But believe me, it can be done. And there are many other ways of tweaking the system. I won't bore you with a lot of details, but I do invite your questions. But let me just run down from my notes some of the ways that are on the system already that you can raise the payroll taxes, you can increase the wage base subject to tax. You could broaden the scope of coverage to include state and local government employees who are not covered under Social Security. Another possibility is investing part of the funds, the Social Security Trust Funds, that are now in special issue government bonds. If there is merit in exploring the idea of investing directly in the markets in equities, why not have the trust fund itself invest part of the trust fund in the equity market. Rather than having individuals under an individual account system take that risk, if there is merit, I'm saying, in that approach, that perhaps logically we might want to consider whether the trust fund itself should take that step. Now, the other side of the coin is, if no way is politically feasible of enhancing the revenue flow, then perhaps at some point down the road we may be faced with the possibility of some benefit reductions. There's talk of perhaps modifying the way the cost of living adjustment is computed. You could perhaps bring that down by 0.5% a year. You could perhaps just reduce all future retired benefits across the board, protecting those who are in receipt of payment now and taking future retirees and saying we can only afford 95% of what's been promised. We could index the retirement age, and this is an interesting concept. You float the retirement age according to the increase in life expectancy. So you move it forward gradually. As life expectancy improves, so you move forward the normal retirement age that you would be entitled to full benefit. Now, all these options are right there on our website, so I do encourage you, go take a look, play the associate game, and see how easy it is to solve this so-called financial crisis. Believe me, it's not hard to do. Thank you.
Thanks a million. I really look forward to this discussion. A couple of the people just came in, potential Social Security beneficiaries. First, my wife, Trudy, who is a great beneficiary. Thanks for being here tonight, Trudy. And another fellow who's not too happy about this federal deficit on his shoulders, my son, Joe Inslee, is a freshman at Western. Well, let's now start a great dialogue here, and we're going to let people fire ideas and questions at random. There's some questions here. Are we doing written questions? Who's in charge, Kenny? Are we doing written questions or what?
No, you're doing written questions, but people can come to the mic. We have a stationary mic here, and they have a roving mic there.
Why don't let's do the roving mic, and people won't have to walk around. I'm going to try to recognize people at random. There's only a couple rules. The First Amendment applies here at Bainbridge Island, so people are allowed to say things that you don't agree with, and you can't throw anything out of Bainbridge High School. It's part of the United States Constitution. We'll try to get to as many ideas and questions as we can so folks can kind of try to get to the point relatively much quicker than congressmen do. That would be great. And why don't we start with this gentleman right here, since Clarence has it. If you can share your name with us, it would be real appreciative.
I'm Bob Smith, and I live here on the island. And I want to know if you agree that the following lies / myths are treasonous. There is no trust fund.
I'm sorry?
There is no trust fund. Do you agree that that's treasonous? Can you say that?
Well, I'm glad we started on a high note here. I don't know, it was a bipartisan discussion. This is the most frustrating issue I have found to talk about, is the Social Security funding mechanism, because there's about 1,000 different ways to describe it. The way I describe it is a trust fund that is a trust fund that does make loans to the general fund, the operating budget of the United States of America.
They're bonds, and it
holds bonds owing by the general fund of the United States government, backed by the full faith and government of the United States of America, to the Social Security trust fund at a certain rate of return. I think it's a very, very secure investment. It's probably the most secure investment you can make in the world that I can maybe think of. You could argue about gold one way or another. So if it didn't do that, you'd have to take the money and put it in a Folgers coffee can and bury it on the south lawn of the White House. And what are you going to do with all the billions of dollars that are accumulating in the trust fund as a result of we want to get rid of people's retirement? Now, how you characterize that is, you know, depending on your viewpoint. I won't get into the treason aspect of it, but I think the nature of your question is getting to the point that there is an asset there that the Social Security Trust Fund holds, which is a note of the federal government.
Right.
And, so, and I think that's the... I think it's important to say
that the government won't pay it. The Japanese investors, but not to us.
It's going to have to pay it. The day that the federal government does not pay a bill, a T-bill, you know, don't worry about anything else. A lot of other things would have melted down by then.
Right.
Do you want to add anything else, Ken?
This is on. Yeah, no. I would agree that this is one of the greatest myths surrounding Social Security and one of the greatest areas of misunderstanding. Certainly there is a trust fund. Certainly it has assets. Certainly those assets are payable. They're subject to the full faith and credit of the United States. And it is unthinkable, in my view, that the U.S. government would ever default on those. I think we're in exactly the same situation as with any other bondholder, that while it is simply a paper transaction to issue a bond in return for cash, the ability of the federal government to repay those bonds when they mature and to pay interest on them during the period held, I think is without question. There's another myth to the extent that these are not real assets, that the money somehow disappears. Well, yes, it's put to work. It's put to work like any bond. If a state or municipal government issues a bond, that money is put to work one way or another. And as long as the ability of the issuing agency or government as a continuing entity is able to redeem those and honor them when they become mature, it should not be in question. And the Social Security Trust Fund has been holding bonds, receiving interest on the principal, and seeing bonds regularly repaid on maturity. It happens all the time. There's no question about the viability of the system. It was set up that way. They simply do not vanish. They are there. They are real.
Hello. My name is Lee Ray Esterberg. I'm not from the island. I'm from Kingston. My question is, years ago, the man who set up the Social Security system was dying, and he was in his 90s, and he said his big regret that he had lived too long. He retired at 65, and the system wasn't set up to keep people that long. And why did it take so long to change the retirement age now, because we do have much longer lifespans than they did 70 years ago.
I want to make sure that I understand your question. Are you suggesting the retirement age should be raised because we're living longer? Are you suggesting that?
Yes. I mean, I think it should have been raised before now. Now they're getting up to 67. But that's we have people now collecting Social Security. I thought I was yelling loud enough. They have people collecting Social Security for 30 years after they retire, and I didn't think the system was set up for that. Even the man who designed it didn't think it was set up for that.
Well, it's certainly what a demographic fact is very true, is that our lives have lengthened substantially. There's absolutely no question about that. However, the rates have been raised accordingly to keep up with that. And we've had these tweaks that have gone on throughout the life of Social Security, which have kept up with those demographic changes. So we're keeping up with those demographic changes. Now, will there have to be another tweak here at some point? Maybe so. And the age of retirement is one of those things, as Ken indicated, there's about 10 things you could do to tweak one or a variety. You don't have to limit yourself either. You could do 2 out of 10 or 5 out of 10 for that matter, any variety of different things. I'll have to tell you, I'm not at a point where I'd want to raise the retirement age, and I'll just tell you why. I recognize the fact that we are living longer, but manual labor is not getting any easier, and our bodies are really not getting longer lived when it comes to doing heavy construction work and heavy manual labor. You know, we're not all in the intellectual property business of sitting around pushing paper. There's some people who are actually working in the world. And it's difficult for me, who has an easy job, except for the airline food, to ask people, you know, to be doing, you know, physical work. And so I don't believe that should be one of the first things that we consider.
Okay, I did.
Yes. Yes.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, yes.
Are they still letting people collect Social Security at 62? Why did they ever start that? I started collecting at 62. But I don't think that was a good thing for the system.
Well, you can send it right back. It's okay.
I do every April 15th.
Let me just address that issue of the impact of people electing to receive benefits early at age 62. There's no real gain or loss either way. The actuarial equivalence concept applies here, that the reduced value of a benefit that you would otherwise be entitled to commencing at age 65 is brought down to age 62. And the stream of benefits from 62 throughout life has the same actuarial equivalent value as that stream of benefits from 65 throughout life. So permitting an individual to begin to receive a benefit earlier than their normal retirement age should not be any significant financial effect on the solvency of the system.
I can stop feeling guilty.
You may stop feeling guilty.
So follow through with the question. We've got one here. There'll be two, three, gosh, four. Woman in the purple here. You're five, and then I'd like to get to the other side of the room, okay?
Hi, I'm June Campbell, and I have two questions. One is this actuarial question, and since Social Security has been in existence for so long and there's been the actuary reports, I'm wondering if you took the historical viewpoint, how accurate were the actuaries, say, like in the 50s and 60s, in predicting things that you now know you can check back and see whether or not they were accurate. And then secondly, I'm wondering also about this life expectancy issue, because recently there have been reports in the newspapers about increasing rates of obesity in children, for example, a lot of chronic illnesses. And I'm not so sure myself that life expectancy is going to keep increasing at the rate that it has in the past. Could you comment on both those?
Yes, I can. In general, the actuarial estimates are pretty reliable over the short term, very much reliable over a 10-year projection period. And the trustees' report do distinguish between short-term projections and long-term projections. And every actuary will admit that the further you go out on the projection scale, the less reliable those projections are going to be. The two areas where there have been the greatest deviation in terms of the actual experience from what was assumed have been, as you had identified, one in the life expectancy or mortality rates, and the other has been in the rate of growth in the economy in terms of productivity growth. The experience has been that actuaries have tended to underestimate the improvement in life expectancy, which is a negative impact because increasing life expectancy will add cost, will add burden to the system. On the other hand, they have underestimated the growth in the economy. So they have underestimated the growth in the payroll taxable wage base, and therefore they have underestimated the flow of revenues into the system. Now, you can only judge the actuarial ability, as you correctly say, by going back historically and looking to see, well, how accurate were they in terms of what has emerged. And if you go back over the last 7 years, a good way of seeing exactly how inaccurate they have been is to see, where is that crossover point? Where is that solvency point? If you go back 7 years, you will find that the actuaries were then saying that the solvency crossover point is, let me just do the arithmetic here, I think it was 2029.
Right.
Each year since then, over the last 7 years, that solvency point has been pushed forward by at least a year, 2 years, 3 years. It is now 13 years further into advance to 2042. That tells me that the actuaries have been conservative, that they have been underestimating the financial strength of the system. Now, maybe they erred one way on the life expectancy, maybe they erred another way on the question of the economic performance and productivity and growth. But the actuaries hedge their bets. They do not make one single estimate. They do have an intermediate set of assumptions called the best estimate. If you read the trustees' report, they have two other scenarios, two other sets of estimates. They have a high cost and a low cost. I call them the high cost is the doomsday scenario, and the low cost is the rosy scenario. And the way to answer your question is to see, where has the trend been? Has the trend been away from what the actuaries are telling us as their best estimate in towards the doomsday scenario or towards the rosy scenario? And consistently, it has been towards the rosy scenario. So that's good news. So that the actuaries have been perhaps a little conservative, but they've been erring in terms of the system actually emerging in stronger shape than they had estimated. Does that give an answer to your question?
What about the life expectancy?
Well, life expectancy is been extended in terms of the rate of growth, and built into the actuarial estimates are certain rates of improvement and rates of acceleration in improvement, or deceleration in rates of improvement in mortality. And those appear in each of the projection scenarios. So you can basically pick your set of assumptions, pick your set of scenarios, and go accordingly. If you go to the trustees report or you go to our website, there are issue papers that deal with that in detail, and I'd be happy to correspond with you or point you in the right direction on that. I've been a champion of what I call sensitivity analysis. In other words, how sensitive are the actuaries' best estimates? What would happen if we deviated a little bit from them on the plus side or on the minus side? And there are detailed position papers on sensitivity analysis that take each of the elements in the actuarial basis and addresses exactly what you're saying. What if the actuary got it wrong by a little bit here or a little bit there? And it shows the impact on that solvency ratio and shows how much it would improve or reduce the financial strength of the system. So the answers are all there on the website, on the position papers.
I want to note that Ken is totally nonpartisan. In his research, he's concluded that Republicans and Democrats both have exactly the same lifespan. So that's good.
Hi, my name is Kel Stokes, and I also live on Bainbridge Island. I'm thinking that in terms of the average age, that's probably a significant factor in the actuary estimate. And then the shift to economic globalization, where we're starting to lose some of our more technical and perhaps some higher paying jobs. And that might affect a reduction in the average wage for Americans over the unforeseeable future. I'm wondering if that's an accurate statement, and if so, if your projections or the projections of the government are taken into account, that our real wages may not grow as quickly as they have in the past.
Well, he's thinking about it. Let me give you just one concern. I'll tell you, if I was making this prediction, I would not make the assumption that our growth curves are going to go down just because it violates principles of optimism. It's not an economic... I guess that's the best thing that would work. But I will say this. I think much more than globalization, I think there is a threat to continuing our rates of growth at historic levels, and that is the reduced percentage of our economy going into research.
And education.
And I think that we are now at a point where we're seeing other players having larger numbers of patents for the first time in American history. And I think that is a potential risk, just to throw one idea. Ken, did you want to say?
Yes, I'm looking at the specific numbers while Jay was talking, just to make sure that I've got my reference right. These are the actual projection numbers for average wage and covered employment. The assumptions are 3.9%. Compare that with an assumed increase in the consumer price index of 2.8%. So you're getting a real wage differential of 1.1%. So that's the actuary's best estimate. I think those are relatively conservative, and when you're making 25, 50, or 75-year projections, obviously it's very, very difficult. But the alternative scenarios, the more optimistic assumptions, would show a real wage differential of 1.6, whereas the high-cost or low-production assumptions would show a real wage differential of 0.6. So you look at that number, that 1.1% difference between the 3.9 assumed rate of increase in average wages per year and the consumer price index assumed at 2.8, and you have to make a judgment. Does that 1.1 represent a realistic estimate? That's the actuary's best estimate. And again, the sensitivity analysis that I'd refer to would look at, well, what if they got it wrong by plus or minus a tenth of a percent either way? So that's possible to be quantified. On balance, independent assessments of the whole package of actuarial assumptions for these projections have been made by oversight review committees, and they feel on balance that they are reasonable. Now, you can take issue with the individual elements in here, as I do from time to time, but broadly, they seem to be, they have hold together reasonably well as a package.
We have about 30 minutes left, so just two more questions from this side. If everyone can limit just to one question. No follow-ups, and I'll get to the other side of the room.
Hi, my name is Gloria Gates, and I'm an Island resident for 37 years. I manage a small medical practice here on the island, and one of my concerns, and it may also be what this gentleman just talked about, was outsourcing and how that affects our Social Security system. For instance, I called to check on somebody's insurance the other day, and the person that I talked to was in Montego Bay, Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And so how much does outsourcing our jobs to other countries affect our Social Security system?
Can you? Is there any specific number that's associated with that?
No, there's no specific factor in the actuarial basis projections. We just take the overall macroeconomic view of a general growth in the aggregate size of the labor force. There are different assumptions about labor force participation. So that, for example, the outsourcing would cause a rapid rise in unemployment that would be permanent and systemic, then certainly that would be picked up in the emerging experience, and the actuaries would then make an adjustment. If, for example, it was felt that prior historical assumed levels of unemployment and labor force participation no longer held, then yes, it would have an effect. So that if there is a systemic permanent change in the structure of the labor force, that would be reflected.
Do I understand the assumed growth rate net of inflation, the assumed growth rate in these projections are less than the real growth rates that we've had over the last 75
yes,
years?
Yes, absolutely. They're very, very conservative. When I quoted a 1.1% real wage differential, and the productivity element for the U.S. economy is assumed at only 1.6. That's very, very conservative in relation to the overall historical growth rate.
Pretty conservative numbers. What else we got here?
My name is Angela de Oliveira. I live on Bainbridge Island. I'm a consulting actuary. I'm a member of the Academy of Actuaries. I'm a member of the Society of Actuaries. I'm a pension actuary. And I'm also an international consulting actuary. And therefore, I'm very familiar with the Social Security systems and the pension systems of countries outside the United States. Because there has been a lot of discussion about, well, there are private accounts in Chile, there are private accounts in the UK, there are private accounts here, there, and if they were a good idea there, then why aren't they a good idea here in the United States? And so my answer to that is that, first of all, I agree wholeheartedly with Jay Inslee's statement that Our program is the envy of other countries. It has, over the last, well, over its history, it has performed with remarkable efficiency, efficacy, and it has provided that floor of security income that it was designed to provide. The reason why Social Security works well in this country is because we have what I call a three-pillar system. Our retirement security is based on three basic tenets. One of them is individual savings. The other is any retirement income that we can receive from employment or from our employers. And then the third one is this social insurance safety net, which is there in case the other two are not adequate. And that has happened over and over. You know, look at Enron, look at all of the retirement plans that have failed, look at, you know, individual savings that have been wiped out. We need to have, I believe, we need to have a social safety net, a floor of income that can ensure dignity and a minimum source of revenue so that the old and the infirm and the disabled have a means of surviving. A number of questions have been asked, you know, problems with, well, you know, if we live too long or if we don't have enough revenue because our growth rates are not sufficient or if jobs are outsourced, you know, how does that threaten our Social Security system? And to that I would say, how do individual accounts resolve that problem?
I think what
we need to have is, what we need to do is we need to expand the basis of contributions to Social Security. And so if we're going to be living longer, we have to encourage people to work longer. I realize that there's a lot of manual labor out there and not everybody can do that. But employers need to be able to hire older workers because it's a fact that our demographics are aging and there's going to be less of a young pool of labor to contribute to Social Security. But we need to consider immigration, we need to consider expanding the basis, as was mentioned, bringing in the state and municipal. I really wanted to make my opinion known, and I think that, you know, these are things that some people may have thought about and may have wondered, well, how do individual accounts resolve this issue? Well, they don't. They're just weakening Social Security.
I just want to dovetail on what you're saying, is to make this really clear, because I didn't say it. You said it with so much credibility, more than I did. The president admits his proposal does not solve the Social Security shortfall. And this is the most incredible fact, to think that he is proposing this, and yet it doesn't solve the problem. In fact, according to his own numbers, it hastens the day when Social Security is, quote, bankrupt, to use his terminology. It makes it sooner. So not only does it, by necessity, either increase revenues, taxes of one sort or another, or it reduces benefits. By the way, benefits for everybody, not just the people going in voluntarily to these accounts, but reducing benefits for everybody as much as 42%. According to his own numbers, it could reduce benefits of everybody, not just the people who want to take their money and invest it in WorldCom and Enron, but everybody, because they're hot stocks. And by the way, people have done that. Everybody could get a 42% reduction in your guaranteed benefit as a result of this. So I really appreciate you coming tonight.
Well, I was delighted to hear from a fellow professional. I strongly agree with everything that you said, and I certainly support those particular initiatives. And glad to hear that we have another fellow professional actuary in the audience, and so I certainly congratulate you for those few points. And with regard to the issue of has the Chilean system or the United Kingdom system or the system in Sweden where we have individual accounts, I'm in contact through the International Actuarial Association with the actuaries in those particular countries, and broadly they're expressing extreme disappointment at the failure of those systems. They're expensive, there's too much volatility in the equity returns, and they are failing to meet defined benefit objectives, so they do not deliver on the promise. So I don't think that we have anything to learn from Sweden or United Kingdom or Chile in terms of whether there are merits in individual accounts to replace the perfectly sound, solid, guaranteed Social Security system. But thank you for your comments.
I'll be over to the right side room in just a minute. There's one fellow back here. I'm very patiently waiting. Sorry, I'm vertically challenged. I missed you.
I'm not sure how patient I was. It seems to me, as the previous speaker pointed out, that we have a three-tiered system, one of which is individual savings. I think one of the great failings of Americans as a people over the last 50 years or so has been to save adequately. We make tremendous amounts of money, and we spend it. And the amount of credit card debt and so forth that we carry is really unconscionable compared to the amount of money that other people in the world are actually saving on incomes far less than ours. It seems to me that we do have a federal program which encourages people to save, and that's the IRA and 401k systems, where we allow people a tax deduction for saving. What is it about this perfectly good program that George Bush finds unacceptable as a way to encourage savings? If you want to leave Social Security safe and secure and not mess with it and take the risk and leave the risk out of it, why not allow people to indulge their risk investment in higher deductibles for IRA and 401ks and 403bs?
You're asking me to psychoanalyze. it's a very important question, because as you pointed out, if the president wants to suggest a way to incentivize increased savings, we have a whole nother 30 good ideas on how to do that by adding on to the Social Security system rather than weakening it and causing hemorrhaging and weakening substantially. I don't know the reason. All I can tell you is, in the defense of President Bush, I think he's sincere, although I would say misguided. He really believes strongly in this. And the reason I know that is that in 1978, when he first ran for Congress in Texas, this was his principal platform when he ran for Congress way back in 1978. This is not a new phenomenon for him. Now, it's interesting. His actuarial projections were not entirely accurate. He ran in 1978 saying that we had to privatize Social Security in 1978 because it was going to be broke by 1988. So those numbers were off a little bit. But he feels very strongly about this issue. I mean, he's going to 60 cities to push this issue. It's a pretty extraordinary amount of effort that the president is making in this effort. So it is a very sincere belief on his. But I disagree fundamentally with his position. This is a nonpartisan gathering, okay? So we're all Americans here. That obviously, that theory has been posited, and I think to some degree it does exist in some of my colleagues. But I guess I would suggest to all of us is motivations don't count here. Reality is what counts. And I'm not going to argue motivations. I'm just going to argue real numbers and real effects. And I think the president's proposal has the real effect of violating a promise that, in effect, my grandmother had me make 30 years ago, 25 years ago. She worked at Bartels in the U District. And sort of when she was getting up in years, her knees really, really bothered her. She was on her feet a lot at Bartels. She was a single mother, raised four kids through the Depression. And I remember talking to her. She showed me one of her prized possessions. It was a pen. It was a Claude Pepper pen with his autograph on the pen. Claude Pepper was, you know, the number one champion for senior citizens in the U.S. Congress. And I remember her saying it. This is kind of weird because I had no idea I was going into politics in those days. And she said, don't ever let anyone touch my Social Security. It's the one thing I've got. I remember telling you that. It's kind of bizarre that we had those discussions at that time. And I really believe the president's proposal has the capacity to reduce the protection of 67-year-old women on their feet in retail establishments being able to retire in dignity. And that promise ought not to be broken. That's how I feel about it.
We've got about 20 minutes, so this side of the room, so raise your hands. One, two, you are two together? Are you two together? Two, three, four, five.
You're optimistic here, Clarence.
Well, I'm trying to do it.
Hi, my name is John Young. I live on the island here. Thanks for coming tonight. Appreciate you guys coming out. Ken, I agree with all the numbers that you've thrown out. I think they're right on. I also think they don't matter in this debate. I think the president has shown over and over that numbers don't matter. That he takes the numbers out of the debate and he focuses on other things. And so my question is for Jay, because I think this is a completely political issue. You've said you're going to do everything you can to fight this proposal. What are you going to do? What can we do to help?
Well, you came tonight, which I really appreciate you doing that. That's number one. Number two, you know, democracy works and voices count. And just raising your voice in every form you can, letters to the editor or one, however you believe about this, even if you disagree with me, getting on the radio, talk shows, calling radio talk shows, letting people know what you think, calling your friends in districts that don't have people who think the way I do, representing them, and get them to be active. All of those things have an impact. And the reason I know they have an impact is that when we returned from our district work period in February or March, when we were back in our districts for a week or so, my Republican colleagues came back shell-shocked. I mean, they looked like they'd been through the Blitz because they were getting an earful from their constituents. And it was not a pretty picture. And that's why the day we got back from our district work period, Senator Frist said, I don't think we're going to do this year. Remember that? And he got a call, I'm sure, from the president. The next day he came back and said, well, I didn't actually mean this year because the word this has a different meaning. I really meant this year, that year, after this anyway. So he backed up a little bit. So that adds up, and I just encourage the people to be vocal. I think it is having a big impact.
My name's Ken. I live on the island. I just had a quick question back on the trust fund. Has it been borrowed from to pay for anything else? I remember hearing something about that, and I'm not sure what the results of that were.
I think not, but I hope I'm right. Do you know, Ken? I don't think there's any other investments by the Social Security Trust Fund other than T-bills, are there?
That's correct. They're all special issue treasury bonds. And
has the accounting of the trust fund been manipulated so that used for other things
other
than Social Security?
Oh, it's part of the general combined government budget, so that if you're tracing where dollars go, once those bonds are issued, once the paper is in the trust fund account, then it's just part of the general revenue stream of the federal government, so that those dollars can be used for education or whatever other purposes that are in the federal budget.
Another way to look at this is, if you took Social Security revenues out of the revenue stream of the federal government, the deficit would actually be over $600 billion rather than $430 is one way of looking at it. Another way to look at it is any particular fund you have, be it the Iraq War or any other expenditure, is wholly funded with Social Security deficit dollars. Is another way to look at it. So whatever, any way you slice it, this is not a healthy picture that we have with these deficits.
My name is Sari Perlow, and I'm from Silverdale. Ken, I want to thank you for telling us about your website, and I really wish that our leaders in Washington would also look at your website. The question that I have is, I find that some of the younger members in my family really like the idea of being able to manage their own money. And what can I tell them about this?
Tell them to start a 401k and a retirement plan, but also tell them that part of the president's proposal. Now, I got to be a little cautious when I say that, because the president, you got to understand, and meaning no disrespect to his proposal, if that's what you want to call it, he really has not proposed a plan. He really has not proposed a plan about how to do this. He's kind of thrown this idea out on the table, and it's kind of flopping around out there. But he's never proposed how to pay for this. Okay, you have to take about, I can't remember the number, billions of dollars out of the current revenue funds out to pay the transition costs if you're going to do this. He today has not suggested how he's going to replace that money. That money has to come from somewhere, those billions of dollars. Now, it can come from one of two places, or actually one of three places. It can come from reductions in two places. It can come from reductions in benefits, meaning you reduce the dollars per month, or you raise the retirement age, or you do something. Or it can come from increased revenues, meaning additional taxes going into the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, he has not suggested which one of those he would propose to do. But if he doesn't propose either one of them, you can tell your son or daughter that it's coming out of increased debt that they're going to have to pay for. Because that's what it's going to have to come out of debt if it doesn't come out of one of these other two places. So you could tell them that if the president's proposal goes through, which is right now, just to have all the benefits and not talk about how he's going to pay for it, it's going to be all deficit spending. And that's what he's proposed today. That's how he's financing the Iraq War, is through borrowing from our children. That's how he's financing that effort, okay? So if he does that, what you can tell your son or daughter is that if they make an additional dollar in investment, they're going to lose a dollar paying interest on the federal deficit. So even if they do happen to be in the fortunate group that do have a net return on their investments, most people do, not everybody, but most people, they end up losing it by additional interest payments on the federal debt. Now let me remind you how big this number is. Let me remind my son Joe, so that maybe I can win his vote next time. The interest payment on the federal debt, okay, the interest payment on the federal debt is now larger than the entire defense cost of the United States of America. That money, we spend more money paying interest on the federal borrowing than we do in the defense of the United States of America last year, and that money goes down a rat hole. We don't get a ship, we don't get a policeman, we don't get a fireman, we don't get an aircraft carrier, we get nothing.
That's a compound.
And yet the president, in the budget that he is going to sign, just agreed to continue that grievous borrowing. And I am very disturbed by it, and I hope some people are here too.
I think George Bush would probably be particularly happy about the fact that we haven't at all discussed means testing Social Security and maybe taking some away from the folks that he'd like to give the permanent tax cuts to. I'd let you guys comment on that.
Well, I know means testing has a surface appeal. I don't support it, and I'll tell you why. One of the reasons Social Security has been so successful, it has been seen as a sort of fundamental all-American right that we all enjoy, and sort of like universal education. We have universal education for our kids, at least through K-12. We have a universality of Social Security. And that's a universality that gives it great political support throughout the ages. And I think once you start means testing a system like that, it tends to go the route of aid to families with dependent children, which was a quote means tested program. And it becomes seen as a welfare program that people aren't really due and owing for what they contributed during their working years. So this has been a very successful program to have that sort of consistency across economic levels, and I think we ought to stick to it. Now, there is a way you can get to this, though. If you want to make the Social Security system more progressive, more fair, and if you want to tweak the system, the most obvious way is to take the cap off at $90,000, so that it becomes a more progressive system. And it becomes fairer because, you know, teachers at Bainbridge High School pay Social Security taxes on 100% of their income. Congressmen pay it on about, you know, 60% of their income. That doesn't seem entirely fair. So that if you want to restore equity to it, you can do it on the tax side, on the revenue side.
I just add that there is a brief on this whole question of social adequacy and individual equity on our website, and that issue brief is well worth reading. It just takes about 5 minutes, and if you want to study that detail in depth, it addresses that means testing or so-called affluence test issue in depth. So we do have an issue brief on that topic.
Before we take another question, we haven't got anyone sort of speaking in favor of the president's proposals. I want to give an opportunity. If, you know, this is a dialogue, and if people are sort of have a little different view they'd like to espouse, I'd like to offer them an opportunity. If anyone wants to kind of come at this from a little different angle, I will protect you from the onslaught. I'm seeing no takers at the moment. If you change your mind, raise your hand. So.
I wanted to say that I've been collecting Social Security for 27 years, but don't forget that when I started collecting it, I was getting $350 a month, which would now pay for my Medicare, my HMO, and my medications. So, and I want to say too that I listened to President Bush one day saying that he would set up a system that would handle these investments on Social Security. So that's where the biggest part of our Social Security money would go to these investors that handle it.
Well, it won't surprise you to know that there would be a few dollars made on this deal on Wall Street, and it's a significant amount. And by the way, you know, when you figure out the return rates, the real return rates, you really have a lot of the projections I've seen forget the costs of handling these accounts and administering the accounts and the fees you pay and setting up and every time you roll over an account. A lot of those projections assume there's zero cost of handling your money, which is nuts, number one. Number two, they also assume that people are going to make an investment the day they turn 18 and not touch it, you know, till they're 82. It's not the way the world works. People have problems, they make investment decisions, they sell, they buy, things go up and down. And in the real world, I think people are really wildly optimistic, a lot of folks' projections I've seen about what could be returned.
One final question up front. There was one in the dark back here, okay, and then back in that corner.
Hi, I'm Sandra from Paulsville. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the portion that people would be putting into these investment accounts is not a portion that would be matched by the employer. Is that correct?
Well, let me think about this. Ken, how would you answer that?
As I have seen the Bush administration proposals, I think that it would be a diversion of the payroll tax on an equal basis. Mm-hmm. So it would be, say, 1% from both employer and employee, or 2% from both employer and employee. And I think the particular administration proposal that is circulating currently would have a total of 4%, 2% for employer, 2% for employee, diverted. There would be a reduction in benefits for the assumed actuarial equivalents of what those accounts would generate if they could outperform inflation on a real basis by 3.5% a year, so you would get your carve out there. But yes, I believe that they would be equally diverted. Now, when you say it's 4%, it doesn't really matter where that 4% comes from, but basically, if it's 4%, you can consider it as 2% employer, 2% employee.
Go ahead.
Well, that's what I was concerned with, because if, in fact, it is part of another hidden agenda to give a tax cut to corporations to relieve them from the match on the portion people would put in their own retirement account, in this private account, then actually what we're just seeing is a backdoor additional tax cut for somebody. But
I think we stumbled on the one positive thing we can say about the plan. It is not a hidden effort to reduce the corporate tax. So we found one thing tonight. It's been a partial success. But let me mention a couple things about the president's proposal that are very important to note. First, the president has suggested that he wants to make this your money so you can decide whatever you want to do about it. But then he turns around and says he's going to have 15 restrictions on what you can do about it in order to save you from your own sort of bad judgment. But you kind of got to have one horse to ride or the other. It's not really going to be your money if George Bush tells you where you can invest it. So it's not really going to be your number of your money. And one, and this is, I can't understand, the president keeps telling everybody, well, you can leave this to your heirs. That's not true. His proposal is the day that you retire, you have to go out and buy an annuity. And that annuity contract would go to you as long as you live, and it's gone the day you expire. There's nothing left for your children when that annuity is gone. So I can't understand how he continues to make that argument. It's 8:27. Perhaps...
Question back here.
First off, I want to give two before we finish. Does anyone want to defend the president's plan here tonight? I'm very open to this idea. I have an open mind, at least for another 40 seconds. Anyway.
He says he doesn't have a plan because if he offered up a plan to Congress, it would be dead on arrival, so he doesn't deal in plans.
Well, that didn't seem too much in favor of it, so I think you're cheating a little bit. One more question, okay.
Jay, my name is Peter Stockwell. I'm from Silverdale. One of the questions I have, if you could clarify for us, is that on these investment payouts, there is some question as to how much money a person would actually have to make on their investment before they would actually see a real return. There's something about a 3% piece in the middle of this, which has to go back to Social Security before you can actually get into making a profit on your investment. Could you explain that?
First off, I don't think there's an honest number you can come up with right now because the president has not proposed what benefit reductions he would suggest to pay for the diversion of funds out of the trust fund. So it might be twice that. We just don't know because he has left this giant piece out of the explanation of how much benefits he'll have to cut. So we really don't know the answer to that on an honest basis. But when figuring that out, let me suggest two things that are frequently forgotten. Don't forget the value of the insurance aspect of Social Security, of the disability and life insurance value of Social Security. It is not just your Social Security retirement income that you get for your Social Security taxes. There's, what, is it 20 to 25%, Ken, of the value? What's the number?
37. 37.
Somebody said 38. I wasn't familiar.
That's not right. Correct.
So, okay, so we just had a bidder. 38%. Value is from these things you don't normally think of on Social Security. So it's very important to figure that in. And second, when you figure out your rate of return, figure out your commissions and your charges and your time and everything else that's associated with administering those accounts, plus with figuring a risk of failure as well. So don't forget those issues. Well, listen, a couple comments before we leave if we can. Ken, do you want to make some closing comments, and I may wrap up. Is there any closing comments you'd like to make?
No, except again, I would repeat the message that please take time to visit the website at actuary.org. There's lots of information there. The work that we have done, the 12 issue papers in particular, have taken about 3 years to produce a team of 12 expert actuaries, so there's a lot of very valuable information. So if you're interested in learning more, please visit our website and feel free to contact me if appropriate.
Ken, thanks a lot. I hope you go to Kansas, too, not just Denver. Just a couple of closing comments. We met in this room last, a bunch of us, talking about our new Apollo Energy project, and I want you to know that we're on track. The House Commerce Committee, I now serve on the Commerce and Energy Committee, and we will mark up the energy bill the week we get back, the first week of April, and we're going to try to infect that bill with as much as we can of the new Apollo Energy project. Don't expect that 100% of it will be in the bill that passes the Republican Congress. But we are very excited about the things that are happening. You saw this week's Bainbridge Review, a couple of Bainbridge Island architects who won a national award for energy-efficient residential construction.
International,
thank you. That's the kind of thing that's really going to make this thing take off, and I hope that we can get Congress to stop being ostrich and be more of an eagle in this regard. Also, with the Arctic, we didn't win a vote in the Senate, but I want to tell you, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end. It is the end of the beginning on this debate. And I want to tell you, the budget, if the budget does not pass, which it did not last year, the Republicans couldn't pass the budget last year, if it cannot pass, and there's a very good chance it will not pass this year, the Arctic will still be protected. So I still have great hope. Last, I want to thank again Barry for putting this together, the brainchild, and thank my staff. There's a gentleman who did the audio. Is it Ken or
Kevin?
Kevin, thanks for the audio. Appreciate it. It's a great movie last night. You can catch his act at the Linwood Theater sometimes, too. Merchant of Venice, great flick. Try it out. Bob, did you want to add something?
I'd like to mention that Barry is a board member of the 23rd District Democrats.
This is a nonpartisan issue, though, Bob. So whatever he belongs to, that's fine. I want to thank you for your ideas. This is going to be a vigorous debate. I ask you to be vocal on it. This is a great start. Tell your friends and neighbors, and let's go get them. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Absolutely.